You're listening to Live from Gold North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. This week, we're joined by the IEA's Head of Education, Dr. Steve Davies, and news editor, Kate Andrews, to discuss generational inequality, one of the most pressing issues in contemporary politics. Young adults in Britain are finding it harder and harder to get onto the property ladder. This, coupled with numerous other concerns, including rising university fees and the cost of living, has left many with a strong sense of grievance about the spread of intergenerational wealth. On our podcast this week, Kate and Steve examine just how serious this divide is. They discuss some of the radical policy changes which must take place to redress this balance, and why mainstream politicians have been avoiding them. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our podcast channel, IEA Conversations.
Steve, regardless whether you associate with the political left or the political right, everyone seems to agree these days that there is some issue of intergenerational unfairness, that young people have it a lot harder than their parents and grandparents did, particularly related to accumulating wealth, how you get onto the housing ladder, how you save up money, how you can even think about starting a family given the cost of childcare being so high. Is this legitimate? Do young people have legitimate complaints against the older generations and against government policy, or are they just being a bunch of whiners?
Well, no, I don't think they're a bunch of whiners. I think there is definitely a problem. It's fair to say that every human society has some kind of implicit intergenerational contract between the older and the younger members of that society. The basic deal, which you find in every society, is that parents look after children and the younger when they're unable to look after themselves, and then in return, when they become a bit old and decrepit, thereby now adult children look after them. This obviously takes a much more complicated form in our society, and I think it is fair to say that there is some problem with that intergenerational contract. It's under stress. But it's important to realise that it's not just one thing. I would actually say that this problem, or alleged problem of intergenerational inequity, actually has three quite distinct forms. One of them is that at the moment, a lot of current public spending, a lot of which is spent on the elderly in the shape of pensions and benefits to pensioners, is being funded not out of current tax revenue, but out of borrowing, which means that the cost of this current spending is being borne not by the people who benefit from it, in particular the elderly, but rather by the young, who are going to have to pick up the tab in the shape of higher taxes to pay the interest on this debt in future years. So that's one element of it. Then there's the fact that the basic pattern of public spending favours the elderly. Pensions have been protected in the context of the public spending retrenchment since 2008. There's lots of benefits that pensioners get, and they are protected from the worst of the public sector stringency that we've had. And then, as you said in your introductory remarks, there's a general feeling that the elderly had it good. They had free university education, they had lots and lots of jobs to go to, they had a world in which housing was very, very cheap and easy to acquire. It cost far less in terms of its ratio to annual income than it does now, whereas now the younger generation have it much harder. They find it very hard, almost impossible, to save up enough to put down the deposit for a house. They can't afford the repayments if they do that even. Childcare costs a lot more. It now takes a lot more effort to get a job, and they've got to pay for their higher education. So that's the burden of the complaint, really. It's the feeling that really my generation, if you will, the baby boomer generation, had it really lucky, very fortunate, and the younger generation is having it much, much harder, in addition to picking up the tab for the bills that are being run up by my generation in our old age.
So it sounds like all three of those points that you highlight have legitimacy, that young people aren't just screaming about nothing. That first point's really interesting and very rarely discussed, that it isn't so simple as to say that the current tax revenue is going to topping up the elderly and usually richer pensioners. That is true. A lot of the handouts that are going to older generations now probably won't be there for young people. Young people won't be receiving those handouts, but they're also going to be paying back what other people had already consumed earlier on in previous years.
Exactly. The problem here is the way in which we have as a society, decided to fund and run the intergenerational contract I mentioned earlier. Instead of money being saved up out of people's working incomes to support them in their old age, we have a system of pay-as-you-go benefits where current spending on the elderly and indeed other groups is paid for out of at best current tax revenue, but increasingly out of public borrowing. And that's what makes it really bad for the younger generation, because, of course, that borrowing has to be serviced. It's largely long-term. It will be rolled over rather than being repaid. And so, as you say, they're not going to get the benefits, but they're going to be paying the bills for a very long time, because they will be paying the interest on all that accumulated debt that has been used to finance these pay-as-you-go pensions and other benefits now.
Our colleague, our mutual colleague, Christian Niemitz, has looked at this issue, particularly as it relates to healthcare, in a report, I think, that was published in late 2017. And he came up with a very similar point that the pay-as-you-go system is not just bad for young people, although it obviously is, but it's also a dangerous system. Because if you have any kind of radical demographic shift, you simply don't have the money to pay off the bills.
Absolutely. And of course, this is precisely the situation we're now facing, because just after the end of World War II, the people who returned from the war decided they were going to have a lot of children. And so there was the famous baby boom, which I'm at the tail end of myself. And that bulge of the demographic population, if you will, is now moving through the years, which means that in a few years' time, we're going to have an enormous number of people becoming entitled to all kinds of benefits, such as pensions, and even more expensively, requiring lots and lots of very expensive hands-on medical care. Now, in the meantime, the birth rate has dropped, so we now have a much smaller proportion of young people having to support an increasingly large and very expensive elderly population. So, as Christian says, the problem with paying things out of your current income rather than saving up when it comes to things like intergenerational benefits is that you can suddenly find yourself caught really short, and that is undoubtedly the biggest challenge that the politicians and indeed our entire society faces in the next few years, I'd say.
And it's almost impossible to see it ending without a huge increase in taxes. And as you point out, that will be paid for by a younger group and a smaller pool of people.
Not necessarily. We might talk about that in a moment. There are other ways you could do it. But the point is, yes, somebody will have to pay for it. And it will have to be paid for by a combination of higher taxes, reduced benefits, particularly for the elderly, and borrowing of some kind. So Yes, can't be avoided.
Let's definitely come back to the benefits point. But first, I want to discuss some of the solutions that others are proposing. I would argue they're not really solutions at all. If you look at the Conservative Party in the last budget, there was a pledge to give under 30s a young person's rail card, essentially extending the young person's rail card for a few more years, as if this was supposed to make up for the fact that young people can't get on the housing ladder. Labour have proposed some more heavyweight policies that you could see being very appealing to the young if they were truly affordable. They floated the idea of returning to free tuition fees in their last general election manifesto. They've spoken about completely free bus travel for young people on the condition that councils renationalized the buses. Putting aside whether it's actually costed or not, they've been speaking about some bigger policies there. The Resolution Foundation, just a few weeks ago, came out with a proposal that all 25-year-olds should be given a £10,000 grant, essentially, when they have their birthday, to help readdress some of the issues of intergenerational inequality when it comes to wealth. Many spokespeople at the IEA were arguing that that's quite an arbitrary age, and it seems unfair that people in their 40s should be taxed more on their savings and what they want to pass on to their kids, who might be on the minimum wage, to top up a potentially very wealthy 25-year-old working in the City of London. But there are these proposals going around. People are trying to address what they do know is an issue. What are these parties and these groups getting wrong, and what are they getting right?
Well, they're right in that there is an issue, and they're now starting to do some serious thinking about what to do about it. The problem is that they're not prepared to face up to the really big fundamental challenges that are posed by our demographics and by the way we've constructed our welfare system over the last two generations. So a lot of these proposals are, like the ones for bus passes and the like, are just window dressing. They're just tinkering around the edges. These are pure stunts, quite frankly. The proposal to recreate free tuition at university for younger people will only benefit, remember, just under half of young people. So it's not just a matter of taxing the elderly to give free tuition to the young. It's basically taxing largely working class young people who've gone into the job market in order to subsidise largely middle class people who've gone to university. It doesn't seem to be a very socialist policy to me, I must say. And The idea the Resolution Foundation has is to address the huge disparity in wealth which is being caused almost entirely by the distortion in the housing market. Now, the idea is, as I understand it, that this capital grant would give younger people, 25-year-olds, the opportunity to get on the housing ladder. Now, quite apart from the objections you quite rightly make of equity and the like, all that will do, absent a major reform in the housing market, is to simply inflate the demand for housing still more and make the problems facing young people in that market even worse. So the point is, they're not actually addressing yet anyway the really fundamental challenge that our demographic situation and our history present us. And I think really that there's three things that all the political parties need to do. They need to stop, and fortunately I think they are beginning to do this, the outright favouritism towards the elderly. There's no doubt that they've been incredibly well treated by both of the last two governments because essentially they vote. It's as simple as that. And I think that things like the winter fuel allowance and the other kind of benefits that are given to often very wealthy pensioners are simply indefensible. And so this outright favouritism has to stop. The big thing that needs to be done is to change the land planning laws. The major cause of the wealth inequality between older generations and the younger generation is the fact that the housing market is completely broken because we have a completely dysfunctional system of land planning laws. Until we sort out the problem of housing supply, you're going to have a constant increase in the amount of annual earnings that you need to buy a house, a first house. And as long as that's the case, young people are going to find it more and more difficult, not just to get on the housing ladder in terms of ownership, but even to rent somewhere to live, because obviously if the price of property goes up, the rental income that you can get from property is going to increase as well. So changing land planning policy and housing policy is perhaps the most important thing that could be done to redress that wealth inequality that the Resolution Foundation is concerned about. That, by the way, would also address the problem of the high cost of childcare, because the main reason why childcare is so expensive in this country, apart from the excessive regulation that we have, is the extremely high cost for nurseries and childcare facilities of the actual physical plant, the buildings that they use. And that basically presents them with a very high fixed cost, which they have to pass on to the consumer.
I haven't heard that before. That's interesting.
So that's the major reason, in fact, yes. The other thing is that, and this is something which will probably have to be done only on a cross-party basis eventually, we need to switch to a more actually contributory welfare and spending system. We need to find some way of weaning ourselves off the pay-as-you-go model of pension spending, welfare benefit spending, and healthcare spending that we are stuck in at the moment, and move towards a system which is much, much more contributory. I think that would be politically very popular, actually. There would be losers in the short run, but I think actually the British public is strongly committed and wedded to the idea of a contributory welfare system. And so that would actually be a way of reforming the contract between the generations. Having said that, the big challenge is social care. We do have this tidal wave almost of people in their 70s, 80s and older who are going to be needing long-term care in many cases. Now, some people will be fortunate enough to live in a healthy life until they die, but many will not, and that's very, very expensive. This is a big, big challenge for public policy, and my personal view is that the only just action is to make the elderly bear a significant part of the cost out of the value of the property wealth that they've accumulated during their lifetime. The Labour Party did suggest this some years ago with Andy Burnham's proposal for a tax which would be levied on the value of an estate on property above a certain value. The IEA has also supported that and criticised the recommendations of the Dilnot Committee and of other bodies that there should be a cap on the amount that can be paid, contributed towards the cost of social care out of private assets, and after that the taxpayer should pick up the tab. I think that given that for most people private property housing is now actually a form of saving, it's only reasonable and appropriate to ask people to make contributions towards the cost of their social care out of that accumulated windfall gain. That will not be popular, but I think that's the only way we can avoid otherwise having really severe tax increases or very large amounts of debt, which will be borne largely by the working age population.
Well, this is very interesting because I'm reading Robert Peston's WTF at the moment. That's his latest book. I'm reviewing it for Economic Affairs. And one of his proposals, which he lays out at the very end, is essentially a wealth tax that comes around every year. Now, that to me actually still seems perhaps a little bit too extreme, but his idea was that if most of your wealth is caught up in your home, and for many, many people it will be, they will not obviously be wealthy people in their spending habits, they won't have a huge amount of income, but they will be sitting in a house that has tripled, quadrupled, I mean, perhaps even more, gone up in wealth in the time that they've been living in it. It's basically, he proposes a tax that you could defer until after you pass away.
Yes, that's similar to the proposal I just made.
But he's coming from a very left-wing perspective, so maybe it's an area of agreement.
The difference is essentially that in his case, the people who are fortunate enough to live a healthy life till they die will be essentially subsidizing the people who are unfortunate enough to have an unhealthy or prolonged senescence, shall we say. That's a question ultimately of moral philosophy about whether you think that's appropriate, and if so, how it should be. I do think that everyone should make some kind of contribution, but I think that there are actually problems with spreading out the burden universally, as he suggests, not least because of the bad incentives that it creates. For one thing, if people knew that their private wealth would bear a significant part of the cost of their care in their old age, it would give them an extremely powerful incentive to look after themselves better and to lead a more healthy lifestyle during their middle age and early later years. So I wouldn't go down the route of full universalism. I still think that the people who actually incur the costs should bear a significant part of those costs if they're able to, rather than put them on the society as a whole or the property owning class as a whole. However, there has to be some element of universalism simply because the fact that there will be some people who require significant care in their old age who do not have assets. So there will have to be some kind of redistributive transfer, otherwise the system's not going to work.
So these are all fascinating ideas, but unfortunately we don't see them coming from anybody in the mainstream of this debate, from the Resolution Foundation to the Conservative Party to the Labour Party. Nobody's proposed building on the Greenbelt. Nobody's proposed building on even a fraction of the Greenbelt. Nobody is embracing the kinds of taxes and restructuring that we would need to make a significantly fairer system. The Conservatives did attempt it in their manifesto, although I would say with quite an ill-thought-out policy to have people contributing more to their social care, and they were destroyed for it.
Yes.
There seems to be a huge appetite to scream intergenerational unfairness and absolutely no appetite to address it.
Unfortunately, this is true. And it's the usual problem with politics, which is that if you propose anything which harms a specific group of people or makes them worse off, even if it benefits the great majority who benefit will be ungrateful and will not pay attention, whereas the people you've injured will scream like mad and take their revenge on you at the ballot box. And both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party have made suggestions in the last 10 years or so to deal with this problem. Social care, for example, and in both occasions it's actually rebounded upon them very, very badly. The only solution ultimately is for people, maybe not the politicians, but people like ourselves, to actually engage in the task of educating the public to make them realise that this is a situation where some tough decisions will have to be made. You do mention things like building on the Greenbelt. That is one area where I think we are seeing progress, because just recently, last week, I believe, we had a motion put down in Parliament signed by members of both the major parties calling for building on the Greenbelt around
led
London.
Led by a Labour MP.
Mm-hmm. I've never been able to understand, actually, why the Labour Party is so averse to this. I can see why the Conservative Party might be. It's always struck me as rather strange that the Labour Party has been so leery about this as well. But this actually attracted support from members of both parties, so that was a very good sign. But unfortunately, I think some of the rest of us have to do some of the arguing and perhaps take some of the flak so that the politicians can then advance behind our scouting party cover fire and actually do the heavy lifting.
We're always having to do that for the politicians, aren't we, Steve?
Yes, indeed.
What happens if things don't change? And what happens if things don't change anytime soon? What's the backlash really going to be?
Well, you're going to have some increasingly serious social problems, I think, because on the one hand, the condition of younger people in many ways, particularly in terms of access to housing, is going to become so bad, I would argue, that you're going to get a whole range of social problems associated with that. Certainly a sharp decline in the birth rate, which had revived a bit, but also just a lot of, you know, human problems of one kind or another. At the other end of the age range, if we don't address and sort out the problem of social care in the next 9 to 10 years, then within about 10 to 15 years, we will have some truly catastrophic situations in lots of places, both at the personal, private level, in terms of families having to face a very severe burden. And I know, speak from personal experience, that looking looking after somebody who has severe dementia, for example, is an absolutely shattering burden to impose upon a family who don't have any kind of assistance, which I saw in my own mother's case, looking after her father. Mm. And so it will be, you know, we will really, really have a very bad situation, both as regards the young and as regards care for the infirm elderly, which is why I think something sooner or later will have to be done. The problem, of course, is that the longer we leave addressing this issue, the more acute the problem will become. And there's a more general question of how we organise things so that that intergenerational compact I mentioned at the start is actually kept in good shape. That involves weaning ourselves off a political habit of letting the future pay for current bills. And that's the major sort of reset in outlook that I think the whole society and not just the political class has got to make.
And the last thing I want to touch on, Steve, is this idea that perhaps, while there is unquestionably an issue of intergenerational unfairness, we are very quick to overlook the benefits that young people do have in 2018.
Yes.
I think the first point I might highlight is that, and I say this as somebody who has a philosophy degree, is that there is a lot of complaint that it's difficult to get a job, that you have to go through a series of unpaid internships that a lot of people can't afford before you can even get on the jobs ladder. But, you know, you don't have to study philosophy for 3 or 4 years at university and then go through that internship process. You could go learn how to code for 3 months and probably walk into a very, very cushy job or freelance and make even more money. So is part of the issue that perhaps young people are in a lucky position where they can almost pursue anything and then end up pursuing things that don't make them a lot of money through choice? The other thing I would touch on is that perhaps the quality of living is significantly better for people our age. That doesn't excuse the fact that public policy is stacked against the young, but there are a lot of things to celebrate if you are young and living in the modern era that, you know, my parents and grandparents will have never gotten to experience in their 20s.
I think all that's very true. To address your first point, actually, I think that younger people under the age of 25, you might say, have been getting what I think is increasingly bad career advice from their teachers and the older generations, which is the idea that really, if you're to be anything in life or to have any kind of success or decent living standards, you've got to go to university. This simply isn't true, and it's increasingly actually less and less true. You mentioned people who go and code. There are lots and lots of ways of making a really good living which don't involve going to university. You should really only go to university if you think you're going to get something out of the process intellectually in terms of your intellectual and personal development. You should not think of it, this is actually a derogation from the real purpose of the university, as simply a way of getting a higher paid job. And if that is your main goal, there are actually more effective ways increasingly of doing that. So I think, unfortunately, a lot of young people have followed the wrong kind of career advice, basically. They need to reassess what it is best to do when you reach the age of 18. Now, as far as the other things go, in one sense, the young have always got an advantage, simply because they're young. You know, I would say this at my age, but, you know, youth is wasted on the young, as somebody once said. You are fit, you're healthy normally, much more energetic, you have much higher levels of energy than the older people like myself. You can do all kinds of things, so there's always a benefit and advantage to being younger. But in addition, being young now is in many ways better than being young in the 1950s or the 1960s, which I can remember from being a child in those two decades. Simply because the world and life in general has got better through things like technological improvement, it's always a benefit to be born now rather than in the past. Certainly right now and for the foreseeable future. And so there are huge benefits now to being a young person in the world of today. You have access to all kinds of products, all kinds of services, all kinds of experiences, which the elderly did not have when they were your age, and which now, because of their age, they can't enjoy in the same way that you can. That is the counterside to the undoubted problems that we were talking about earlier.
There was a fantastic Daily Mash or Onion article, and the headline read, "Now is the worst time for a young person to be alive, apart from the two world wars." And if you think about it from that perspective, you know, it really accounts for everything. It's not to say that there aren't serious issues facing young people today, but perhaps young people have a larger role to play in determining their own destiny as well.
Yes, indeed.
Steve, that was fascinating. Thanks so much for joining me.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.